playoff time. We've been waiting for this for a long time. We're going to do a playoff preview edition here today on the Dunked On Basketball podcast, brought to you by us, our survey, actually, that we want all of our listeners to use at podsurvey.com/capsace. We'll tell you more about that and how you can help support the program in a short while, but let's just get right started. We didn't get a chance yesterday to talk kind of about what happened in the East with the seeding, because we kind of did that special episode just on the 60 and the 73. But yeah, I mean, that whole division winner thing, despite the fact that it had theoretically been excised, ended up mattering in what the seeding was in the East playoffs.
Yeah, it was excised, but it wasn't excised enough. They did this really fascinating thing where the league, I don't know who it was a concession to, conceptually, I guess it was a concession to somebody, said that the tiebreakers for two teams and the tiebreakers for more than two teams had a different ordering, and the biggest difference between those two was that in a multi-team, in a two-team one, division winner was below head-to-head, and in a multi-team, it was above it, and so that ended up figuring into what ended up happening based on that crazy last day of the season.
So these, I mean, it was an awesome game that got overshadowed by what happened later on the West Coast, where the Celtics came back from down 26 to actually win by 10, and it all ended up being for naught because the Hawks ended up losing in Washington. There's reporting that at least some of the Heat players from Ethan Skolnick thought that the Hawks were trying to tank to avoid having to play the Heat, which is what I think would have happened if they had won. The Heat would have fallen all the way down to the number 60 due to that weirdness in the tiebreaker. But I don't know if I buy that. I think the Hawks would have much rather been the 3 seed and avoided Cleveland for as long as possible. Cleveland's a bigger scare than the Heat are. But, you know, I'm sure that the Heat probably scare people a lot more than the Celtics or the Hornets do, because those teams don't have a superstar and they're kind of young teams that have ascended, whereas the Heat, quote unquote, know how to win. We'll get to a bit more of those stereotypes as we get into that Heat Hornets preview. But anyway, what ended up happening, because the Hawks lost, was an unprecedented, according to our friend Kevin Pelton, unprecedented four-way tie for what would have been the number 3 seed, and they had to parse it out somehow. So I don't think the NBA deserves too much blame, considering a four-way tie is has never happened before.
Yeah, it's this split of two different things. Like, it wasn't that big of a, you know, that big of an oversight. I think they should resolve this, not ambiguity, this inconsistency, personally, because I think that rewarding the division winner. But what is fascinating about it isn't so much, you know, that. It's that it would look completely differently if all they did was switch number 2 and number 3 of the tiebreaker criteria.
Let me ask you this, just from a fairness perspective, if we want to say we want to reward the team that inherently was the best team in a tie situation. You know, I think head-to-head is good for a two-way tie. Once you get into three-way, I'm not sure that it's as good. Maybe it is. And maybe even four-way, it could kind of still be head-to-head as well. Is that the fairest way to do it? Or is there, put your thinking cap on, is there another way that you think might be fairer?
I would love to do point. So for a multi-team tie, do point differential or, you know, something of that nature of common of those games between those teams. So then it's not like, oh, if you beat a team by 20 and lose by 2, that those are exactly the same thing. And I would go more in that direction. It also does incentivize being a little bit more aggressive and not just putting the brakes on when you're getting whooped. I think that would be a little bit better. But as a fundamental thing, I don't think that being a division winner, I think that they should, of course, I think they should make the playoffs. It's really unreasonable to think that they wouldn't if you're going to go with the current format. But it is weird to have it that high a tiebreaker, because if you think about it, to me, if you have two teams that have the same record and one of them presumably has a team that is above them, in some ways that's more impressive than being the best team in your division.
Yeah, that might be right. And, you know, I think point differential would be fine. You wouldn't want teams playing their starters even more than they already do just to try to fix their point differential, especially early in the season. But, you know, there are plenty of, like, European leagues, whether it's in soccer or in basketball, where, you know, point differential, goal differential really comes into play from previous games.
And if it was just common games, it would be too abstract for you to really do it. You know, if it was the common games, you have no idea who you're going to be tied with. I mean, look at this. They never could have anticipated this ahead of time.
Yeah, anyway. All right. We're getting a little too theoretical here. We got lots to get to. We're going to go in order of the series debuts on TV. So if you're listening to this, you can hopefully finish up. Maybe if you have time to finish up all of them before the playoffs start, we'll give you another day to get to the Sunday games. Toronto and Indiana, it will kick things off as the early game on Saturday. Injury-wise, the big question for Toronto for quite some time has been Jamari Carroll. He says that he's been feeling good. He asked for his minutes limit to get lifted in the postseason. He played three games and sat out two, both of which would have been on back-to-backs, playing between 14 and 21 minutes in those games. I didn't watch a ton of Toronto because they weren't really playing games that affected the playoff race to any great degree in the last week or so. But I thought Carroll at least looked to be moving relatively well. But they've also had Norman Powell emerge in his absence, and we'll talk a little bit about, you know, what the playing time distribution might be for Toronto. And then the other thing that really should be watched, though he's not, we haven't heard much about it recently, is Kyle Lowry's elbow. He needed to have that elbow drain, I think, a couple of weeks ago. He's rested, I think, three times down the stretch, not an insane amount, and hasn't played that many minutes, but he's shot 50% in only one game since March 18th. And he wasn't, most of the other ones besides that, he wasn't really close. It was, you know, 4-for-13, 7-out-of-17, 4-out-of-15 type of games a lot for him. So that is a concern if he, you know, and he certainly wore down last year, not this late in the season, but that's a concern if he's not going to be, you know, Kyle Lowry, the type of guy who, you know, was a top 10 player in this league this year.
Kyle Lowry is a non-negotiable part of Toronto's success in any series, and particularly against against an Indiana team that can be inconsistent, and getting him to play at a steady, positive level would really help them weather any potential storms that the Pacers give them.
For the Pacers, CJ Miles, a sore right shoulder. He is left-handed. That probably helps a little bit. He says he's going to play. He had been hot in April after slumping for a bit. Hopefully that's not an injury that really will affect him very much. You have been saying for a long time, and I didn't really understand why, although I hadn't thought about it that hard, and now I'm kind of getting into it a little more, that you really wanted to see this series. What are you looking for in it that has you so excited about it?
The Pacers have specific personnel that I think will give the Raptors problems. They have George Hill, who, when he's healthy and engaged, is a very good defender of point guards. Paul George, when he's on, is one of the best perimeter defenders in the game. And the Raptors, while they have many gifts and they're a very talented team, a deserving number two, they don't really have somebody to combat Paul George other than Damari Carroll. So if he's playing, that's great. You hope that. And I'm excited because while they tried a series of different things, some of which we criticized and some of which we praised, the Pacers ended up being one of the few teams that successfully implemented a two-big lineup. And Toronto doesn't have a ton of great standstill shooters. They do a lot of driving. And it's a lot less effective to do that when the team has Jan Mahimi and Miles Turner standing there in the middle with their big arms up. And so I think that, well, Toronto is the favorite on talent, and they have home court advantage. Indiana can give them a series. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to win, but I think that each game is going to be compelling. And DeMar DeRozan is a guy that I've been critical of for years. I just think that he's a little bit overrated, and he is going to have to prove his mettle in this series right before he becomes a free agent.
Yeah, he's had a very nice year this year, but Paul George is just about the guy that you could create in a lab to lock him down. Even someone like Jimmy Butler doesn't have the length that George does. George is 6'9", 6'10", huge wingspan. And what DeRozan likes to do, he's not incredibly quick side to side, but he kind of has all these moves. He'll pump fake, and either you're going to get rooted to the ground, scared of the pump fake, and he'll be able to shoot over you, or you end up jumping and fouling. But George has the length where he doesn't have to overcommit to DeRozan's mid-range jump shot, and, you know, just one of the best defenders in the league. I think he will guard him pretty darn well, talking about DeRozan. And then you mentioned George Hill. He can match up on Lowry. And if Toronto goes with the starting lineup that they've had for some time, then they can kind of hide Monte Ellis on Norman Powell, who has played well but is not a guy who's going to be, you know, just killing Ellis. The starting lineup matches up pretty well. They have some pretty good defensive centers or at least one in Mahinmi, although he is prone to foul trouble, to match up with Valanciunas to start the game. And then what really is going to be the most interesting part of this to me is what happens with Carroll and what happens at the power forward position for both teams. Is Carroll going to play the four? Is he going to play the three, start at the three over Norman Powell? Instead, that would make it a little harder to hide Ellis on him, although you probably would still do it. Carroll's a lot bigger than Ellis, but, you know, not a guy who's going to have the ball in his hands. So there's that aspect. And then for the Pacers, is it going to be Solomon Hill, who's actually been getting a lot more minutes lately, despite having his rookie option declined, which we both have railed against? You know, that enables them to get real switchy on the perimeter if they want to. Well, they've been starting LaVoy Allen, but he's kind of been playing 18 minutes. Jordan Hill has been out of the rotation. Are they going to go with both Turner and Mahimi at the same time, which had success for a while and then kind of fell off? Where they go with that four position, Indiana especially, to me, is going to determine quite a bit.
And they play with a lot of effort, and as you mentioned, there are a lot of potential pieces. You know, there are some teams where their closing lineups are pretty clear. While both these teams have maybe a grouping that we would expect to see, there are guys who, when they're hot, you know, I've been a supporter of the idea of CJ Miles playing over Monte in crunch time lineups, just because I don't think Monte provides much surplus value in those units. And so will Vogel go to that? And as you said, will they go small? Will they go big? Because these are both things. And also, I don't think it's going to happen, but my eternal joy if we get these small stretches of time with Monte Ellis guarding Luis Scola would just be the most amusing thing in the world.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen, but that would be rather amusing. For Toronto's standpoint as well, I think that Terrence Ross kind of has a better pedigree than Norman Powell. He kind of fits the idea of a bench gunner. If they're going to start Damari Carroll, now who is next in that wing rotation? Is it Ross or is it Powell? James Johnson probably will be kind of kicked out. Are they going to actually start Patrick Patterson, which they probably should do, or are they going to kind of stick with Scola? I mean, I think that both of these teams maybe are not starting their best lines. I think that Solomon Hill is probably better than LaVoy Allen, especially in a series like this. And I think that CJ Miles is probably better than LaVoy Allen as well. If the Raptors are going to start Scola, they've been resting him a lot. I don't know whether that's because he needs the rest or because he's kind of fallen out of favor for the starting lineup. I mean, Patterson is clearly a better player than him. Carroll can play some four. I think that these are both teams. And then also for the Raptors, is it going to be Biombo or is it going to be Valanciunas to close? I kind of like Biombo because Valanciunas, if you're not going to ever throw it to him, which of course they never do down the end of games, the Lowry and DeRozan show, then why have him out there? Why not just go with the better defender? So all of that, I think, it is going to be really, really interesting. These are teams that don't start optimally. We see a lot of times in the playoffs, teams don't actually turn optimally. Like you think of Portland last year, they wouldn't start Myers Leonard and CJ McCollum until they were basically completely out of that series against Memphis. So who's going to get to their best lineup first? Who is going to kind of, you know, stick traditional until they're down and it's too late? You know, I think that's going to be interesting. And this series is really starting to appeal to me a lot more now that I'm starting to get into it. There are a lot of very interesting strategic questions.
And it's going to be fun. I think we'll be watching the first game of this at Oracle together, probably.
Yeah, that's true, in the media room. So what is the conventional wisdom that you've kind of seen today about what's going to happen in this series, and is there any kind of deviation between that and, you know, what the advanced stats say?
From what I can tell, people, I think, are a little bit more on the Raptors than maybe I am. It was fun. I just talked with Arturo Galletti, and his model actually has these teams pretty close, and that's, you know, one person's advanced stats.
And that's interesting, yeah, because 538 has the Raptors as 82% favorite over the Pacers in this. The Raptors had a 4.5 point differential. The Pacers were at 1.7, so probably a little bit better than the Pacers record indicated. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I guess most people just think the Raptors are going to roll.
Yeah, I think that's mostly what I haven't heard. I've heard a little bit of like Indy can make it a closer series. And I think that might actually be closest to the right interpretation of it. I'm not sitting there going, this isn't my Warriors are going to beat the Nuggets thing, where it's just like the series that I'm standing on an island on. It's just, I think it's going to be more competitive. And I think that Toronto had such a wonderful year. And the other weird aspect of the series, and this will be, I think it's more true in this series than most other ones, is we don't know how healthy the Raptors are. And I think that is something that could...
Lowry specifically. And Lowry, I guess, Carroll
specifically. Is, you know...
And also, we didn't even talk about this. Who's going to guard Paul George for the Raptors? It's got to be... Carroll's really the only guy who's a two-way player who's qualified to do that. And Paul George, He's not quite the kind of post-up bully guy that Joe Johnson was 2 years ago who killed the Raptors. But, you know, he's close. He kind of likes mid-rangers. He likes to just shoot over the top. If Carroll isn't ready to go, and I guess he will have to start then over, if he's ready to go, unless he's like still having trouble with that knee, he's going to have to start over Norman Powell because they'll just want anyone to guard George otherwise. If Carroll can't go or gets in foul trouble or can't play that many minutes, is it going to be James Johnson trying to guard him? Like, he's pretty miserable on offense, is really bad at executing defensively, even though he has the physical gifts. Is it going to be Powell who's going to be, you know, posted up to death? And then there's, or maybe it'd even be Patrick Patterson, who they tried on Joe Johnson 2 years ago, but he's improved a little bit guarding those guys, but he's not going to, Patrick Patterson can defend in ISO okay, but he's not going to be like a good pick and roll defender. Yeah, this is, the more I think about it, the less I like this matchup for Toronto, frankly.
Yeah, and also something that I love to harp on, and we'll talk about this eventually with the Spurs, though not in this round, is on-ball versus off-ball perimeter defenders. And so Paul George is weird for a lot of teams because he's more of an on-ball guy, especially with George Hill kind of bouncing around. George Hill's actually a great catch-and-shoot guy. So one of the benefits with the Pacers is that they can get some defensive players discombobulated because most threes aren't really used to that. Damari Carroll did a pretty good job on LeBron when he was healthy before his with that crazy knee injury last year. And LeBron is, of course, the most ball dominant.
He did. I remember him getting his butt kicked, actually.
I thought, he fought hard, I guess.
He didn't weigh enough. LeBron was just kind of like putting him in the goal.
But in terms of what I mean in terms of that is
he's good, though.
Extrapolating
he's good,
though. With Paul George is like defending LeBron and defending Paul George are very different things. But like there are some perimeter guys that just have trouble on ball. And I think that is everybody on the Raptors except for Damari Carroll. So I think that would be a challenge because if Paul George is, you know, initiating and doing things like that, I think Patrick Patterson would not be happy with that, let's say.
Yeah, Powell, he might be okay. Like he could, maybe he can get into George if George wants to try to attack off the dribble in pick and roll. I don't think he actually would be necessarily be that successful. He would probably have to go more in the post. George doesn't really like fighting for position that hard on offense and really trying to get close to the basket on kind of his post-ups. He really likes to have the ball in his hands and then pull up for a mid-ranger. So I don't know. Maybe it's possible that Powell could do better than I think he could. But I don't know. I mean, it's a 4-inch height differential between those two guys, even though Powell does compete and he's athletic and has length. All right, enough farting around here. Your prediction?
Raptors in 7.
I do think it is going to be very competitive. I will go Raptors 7 as well, just due to the home court advantage. I think that ultimately will make the difference for Toronto. Before we move on to Warriors Rockets, I want to tell you about a survey that you can do as a huge favor to us. You're kind enough to listen to us, we hope, for a couple hours a week, and we want to ask for 3 minutes of your time in exchange to help keep our podcast free, help us get some sponsors. We're just basically an independent podcast. We don't have financial backing from ESPN or everyone else. I just own it. And so I have to get sponsors basically to keep the lights on in here and keep this thing going. We started to do a little bit better, but now we have the survey available that if we get a good response rate can help us get some more sponsors. Also, if you fill it out, you can get a $100 Amazon gift card. One of the people who responds will get that. The way you fill it out, go to podsurvey.com/capspace. podsurvey.com/capspace. Usually between 2 and 8% of listeners respond to these surveys. And the more of my listeners that respond, the better we look to advertise. So if we could break some records, get up to like 10% of listeners to respond, maybe even more than that, that would be unbelievable. I know from our sponsors that we have already that we have a very engaged listener base, people we hope are hardcore fans that really like to get into the nitty-gritty the way we do, and we really appreciate the support. It's podsurvey.com/capspace. I have the link pinned to the top of my Twitter page at @NateDuncanNBA. You can just go there too. Thank you so much for your support. We really appreciate it. Warriors Rockets, let's do some injuries first. Not a ton here. Terrence Jones has been in and out of the lineup. He was in the concussion protocol for a long time. He had an illness, but he was a healthy scratch on Wednesday against the Kings. There's no one else who projects to be unavailable for the Rockets other than Sam Decker, who has been out forever. And for Golden State, the only one who's really been dealing with anything is Kevon Looney, although Sean Livingston did take a little bit of a spill on Wednesday and was kind of limping around. I think it was just kind of like he fell hard on his tailbone, so he'll be okay. I mean, he didn't have any ice on anything after the game, so I think he'll be all right. It might be something to watch a little bit, but, even if they don't have him, they'll be fine in the series. What are you looking for in this series in kind of a macro sense?
How much time does Steve Kerr give Draymond at center in this kind of a series? You know, that's I'm sure the Warriors will go to it heavily when they need to, but they might not need it that much in the series. So will he kind of keep that workload low, give more to Bogut and Azili and maybe most Spates depending on the matchup, and keep basically save that for rounds 2, 3, and 4? Or will he just basically sweep the leg and go for it more early because the Rockets do not have a counter for it?
Yeah, you at one time you might have said that Dwight Howard posting up on the offensive glass, his ability to switch out would be a pretty good counter for that. He is not that guy anymore, from what I can tell. They do not go to him in the post very much any longer, and he is not going to be able to be effective, I don't think, against Draymond Green. And then offensively, if he has to switch on to Curry, I don't expect that that's really going to work too well either. So yeah, that is a great question of, you know, another coach, Kerr, knows what his best lineup is. I mean, he has plenty of reasons for not playing it in the regular season, you know, might tire Draymond out. But yeah, I mean, I think they kind of go conventional, and then maybe at the end of the first half, they'll go to it for 2-3 minutes. You know, when he's really going for the kill, when he's really, really going for the kill, he'll just start that lineup. When he's kind of sort of going for the kill, he'll try to get that unit a couple of minutes in the first quarter as well, before Klay Thompson subs out, and Harrison Barnes sub out. So we'll see what happens there. I agree that nobody has come up with even a remote counter for that lineup yet. I think that the other thing I'll be looking at is just what Houston is going to do at the four. And are they, I mean, they've played Capella and Howard together a little bit. You have to imagine that's not really going to work. They will go with Trevor Ariza at the four sometimes, but then you don't really have another good wing guy. Corey Brewer has just been off all year. Is it going to be Michael Beasley who's actually closed some games for them at the four? Now you're getting into guys who just have pretty much like no communication skills, you know, no discipline on defense, someone like Beasley. And so maybe they'll think, all right, we just got to try and outscore these guys. But I don't know. I mean, they just don't really have a great option at the four. Demo is going to be too slow. You put him in pick and roll. It's going to be a disaster if he's got to guard Draymond Green or even Harrison Barnes. It's not going to be good either.
I just want to see Beasley versus Barnes, see if Harrison Barnes can actually attack Michael Beasley.
Yeah, that'll be interesting as well. I think you probably can. I mean, but Beasley, it's not even so much one-on-one as it is just communicating, being disciplined.
Back cuts.
Yeah. And the other thing that just killed Houston in the series last year is anytime Harden was out of the game, and it's really kind of been true for them all year this year too, that they just couldn't score. They were like, I think, pretty close to even in the minutes that Harden played in that series, and then just got waxed in the rest of the minutes. And then one other thing that you mentioned, which is kind of terrifying, is just, you know, I hopefully it won't get to the point of an injury, but just, is Patrick Beverley going to try to just go completely crazy and like really try some dirty tricks, like throw Steph off his game?
It certainly is a concern. I'm not saying Patrick Beverley is a dirty player in any way. It's just that I think he's a very competitive.
I thought that move against Westbrook was kind of a dirty play. I actually wrote that at the time in 2013 when he injured him, but go on.
I think that his idea is basically he's a very competitive guy, and he knows that his best chance for the Rockets to win is for him to get under Curry's skin and make life hard on him. And those, even if a guy's not dirty, if he's hyper-competitive and gets that close to the line, there's a risk involved.
Yeah, the Rockets are a team that has had one of the worst transition defenses all year. They've been horrible. Even when Beverley has played, he used to be someone who gave great problems. No longer. Curry has killed the Rockets all year. But I think Beverley has slipped a little bit. Howard has slipped a little bit. But at their peaks, Ariza, Beverley, and Howard are all players who can be pretty darn solid on defense. And then you got Harden, and then, you know, now you're kind of out as far as good defensive players. Corey Brewer looks like he'd be a good defensive player. He's too undisciplined. So, and then whenever they go to their bench, those guys are not really any good on defense either. The transition defense is just going to be a massive problem. The ability to score for anyone other than James Harden is going to be a massive problem. You know, Andre Iguodala and Harrison Barnes did a nice job. That'll be one thing to watch, is do they give Clay the initial assignment again on Harden after Harden just torched him last year, to the point where Clay was saying he was like kind of working on his ISO defense. Didn't specifically mention Harden, but it kind of seemed obvious that that's who he was talking about. Or do they go with Barnes, who had inexplicably kind of more success. He's just a little bit stronger, can challenge Harden's step backs a little bit more. And then obviously Andre is awesome too, on Harden. So that'll be, I assume Kerr is just going to start conventional Bogut, Clay on Harden, you know, blah, blah, blah. But we'll see how long that lasts. Is there anyone you think like who's in the regular season rotation in these for either of these two teams that might just kind of not really play at all in the series?
I'm going to be really interested to see what second unit players Kerr keeps and doesn't keep. And again, it might not be representative in the first round. So Spates, Brandon Rush, you know, guys like that. Livingston and Barbosa and, of course, Iguodala will always have a place. But how they handle everything else is pretty up in the air.
I predict that Donatas Mata-Yunas will not be starting at the end of the series. He may not even be starting at the beginning of the series. It is even possible that there will be some games where Capella plays as much, if not more, than Howard as well. I don't think Terrence Jones is going to play. Josh Smith has been exhumed lately. Like, he might actually get a little bit of time. I think that Bickerstaff is just going to be cycling through all of these guys that they have at the four, all of whom, frankly, are probably inadequate options. KJ McDaniels as well. I mean, maybe JB praised his defense as having improved. Like, that was one of the things that he really struggled with, was closing out on shooters early in the year. He's improved his footwork on that, according to Coach Bickerstaff. So if McDaniels can play at the four and be effective, maybe that's a new way that this team can play. And his energy, McDaniels, could be pretty impressive. But, you know, also another guy, young guy, not known for his ability to execute defensively. And that sometimes even more so than just your physical abilities, that ability to communicate, switch, be mentally locked in, you know, never lose your guy, stay attached, get back on defense. Those in some ways are more important than just simply, oh, I have the quickness to keep Steph Curry in front of me on a switch or something like that.
There is also an irony to one of the things that happened between these two teams during the season was Ty Lawson continued talking about Steph Curry, and he's not a member of the Rockets, and the series happened anyway.
That's pretty funny. All right, prediction?
Warriors in five. I think Houston, Warriors in four is, I think, a reasonable call. Everybody who's saying that, I'm fine with that. But I feel like, I just have this feeling that the Rockets will just sneak a game, probably game four. The Warriors are just basically, they're happy with what's happened, and the Rockets win it by, like, let's say 5 to 7 points.
Yeah, the Warriors are a team that can kind of start showboating, not taking things seriously. Like, they'll, like, inexplicably look bad every once in a while. I mean, I could see Harden just going crazy in one of the games at home or something. I mean, it'll be four or five, but I will say five as well.
God, we're agreeing a lot.
Well, there's something else that we agree with, and that is that SeatGeek is an awesome place to buy and sell tickets. They are a sponsor of your show. They are the inaugural sponsor of my show. It's just simply the best ticket buying app out there. And if you join up now, you can use the CapSpace code, same code we use for everyone, very familiar because we talk about CapSpace all the time on the program. That will cause SeatGeek to send you $20 after your first SeatGeek purchase. Go into the settings tab, put that code in. SeatGeek is so awesome because, number one, it's an aggregator. So if you're trying to buy tickets, you don't have to worry that you missed out on cheaper tickets elsewhere. It's just all in front of you right there on the app. Number two, they have a metric called deal score, which green is for good deals, red, not so good. So you can kind of tell what's a good deal and bad. Same thing if you're trying to sell the tickets as well. That really helps. They don't have any hidden fees. You know what it's going to be right up front. You don't select your tickets, get all excited, check out, and oh yeah, it's $20 a ticket extra for some fees that weren't disclosed up front. So SeatGeek is just the best way to go. There's plenty of NBA playoff games coming up. They're going to be tough tickets. SeatGeek is the best way to buy some. And if you're one of those season ticket holders who wants to sell a game to kind of help pay for next year, you can do that with SeatGeek too. Go into that settings tab, add a promo code, CapSpace on the SeatGeek app, get that $20 back. Dallas and Oklahoma City. Where are we at on the injuries for these guys?
Everybody's hurt on Dallas. Darren Williams has a sports hernia. Berea has a groin issue. Both of those guys are, I assume they're going to be playing whether they're 100% or not. Devin Harris has a sprained left thumb, but he's going to try to play. David Lee has plantar fascia issues with his right foot, which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
And of course,
yeah, he hurt that in the San Antonio game.
And of course, handsome Chandler Parsons is out for the rest of the season.
Yeah, D. Will has looked okay. He killed Utah in that game. Berea's groin injury, he did not play on Wednesday and did not play against the Clippers on Sunday. He did give it a go against Utah, did not look like himself, only was 2 for 11 in that game on Monday. Hopefully he will be ready to go, but those type of injuries, especially in the playoffs, when you can't let it fully heal, it's very susceptible to re-injury once you warm up, once you really get going. And D. Lee, I do feel bad for him. You know, he seems to get injured right at the start of the playoffs, seemingly every year. Even last year, he had a back injury, the injury that he had that may have enabled them to beat the Nuggets in 2013, but you felt bad for him since that was like his first playoff appearance of his entire career, you know, 7 years into his career or whatever it was. So if he can't go, he actually has been, you know, he hasn't been good, but he's been okay, effective for them. Maybe you could say Dwight Powell is a better player just due to his defense and maybe being a little bit better a shooter. But D-Lee definitely helps on offense for them. And then Oklahoma City, the only issue they have, Mitch McGarry has been away from the team on an undisclosed personal matter for quite some time, but he doesn't really matter at all to them. This is just about the blurst of matchups for Dallas, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to need Wes Matthews and Anderson to have the series of their career so far on Durant to even make this relevant.
Yeah, it'll be a nice test for Justin Anderson. I don't know if he is going to start or not, but they're just big problems all the way around for the Mavericks. Number one, Wes does not, you know, would have been challenged even when he was in his heyday as a defender to guard Durant. Wes is like 6'5". On a good day, Durant is almost 7 feet tall and has incredible length. And Durant's probably more athletic than Wes is as well. Justin Anderson probably does not have the level of discipline to guard an NBA superstar. He's barely been playing until the last month and a half. Although at least Oklahoma City is not doing anything too tricky. So, you know, his inexperience may not be as much of an issue. But, you know, I could see him, like, getting a bunch of fouls just on, like, the rip move or, like, getting pump faked in the air, those sort of crafty type of plays. At point guard, they have nothing even approaching a defensive stopper. Maybe Harris is, like, the closest it comes to that to guard Russ. If they do a 3-1 pick and roll, where is J.J. Barea going to hide? You know, I guess he'll hide on whoever the two-man is. They've got all these small point guards that they want to play, and those guys, none of them are great defenders. And Oklahoma City does not have the most complex offense, but against Dallas, sometimes you don't need that because then you have your inadequate on-ball defender, and now he's going to get put in pick and roll with whoever Dirk is guarding, and that's going to become a pretty big issue for them as well. It's just, you know, Zaza Pachulia, not a guy who has a ton of athleticism to protect the rim. Westbrook is a guy who struggles against good rim protectors, but if he doesn't have to worry about that, he can go right to the cup and lay it in. It's just nightmare matchup for Dallas. I would have liked them much better against the Spurs than against Oklahoma City, even though the Spurs have been a better team all year.
Yeah, I think it's a very unfortunate thing for them, and they just don't have the personnel. And Serge Ibaka, Dirk has had some solid games against the Thunder, but Serge Ibaka is the type of guy who you can kind of put him on an island in that sense, and you don't have to send as much help, and that's one of the ways that Dallas can beat you is because Dirk can pass, and you just put Ibaka out there and just let him do his best.
Yeah, this is also a team that has fast mobile rim protectors, so Dallas, their big play is pick and pop with Dirk. You got it. The big has to stay attached to Dirk, and guys like Barea, D. Will, Raymond Felton, Harris, guys who are pretty limited themselves, can just get right downhill to the basket. But then the other rim protector is going to be there. You know, someone like Ibaka can cover a lot of ground as well, so that he doesn't necessarily have to stay that hard attached to Dirk. Dirk is going to, you know, he killed Ibaka in 2011 when those guys were at much different places in their careers, but now he's not going to have any kind of chance of just posting up and creating a bucket onto Dirk. Also, the Thunder are very difficult even when you get switches on them. Like Durant, you know, can guard Dirk reasonably well. And even guys like Westbrook, Deion Waiters, like they're not that easy to post up. They can at least push Dirk out a little bit. And then, you know, the Thunder have a ton of mobility to go double Dirk if they need to. Maybe Rick Carlisle will be able to get one game out of this, but I think I'm going to go ahead and predict that this is going to be a sweep.
I think it's going to go five just because Carlisle has done that kind of thing before. After they took that Spurs team to seven, I kind of said to myself, I give Carlisle's teams a couple extra games in the regular season. I don't think I'd ever predict his team to be in a sweep. Even I think against the Warriors, I probably wouldn't have predicted that, but five is fair. You know, so either way, I mean, it's the chances of Dallas winning this series, which is, of course, the more important thing, are exceedingly low. And, you know, maybe they push it to five, maybe they push it to six, but they're not going to win.
Oh, and don't forget, Dallas is not really that good at defensive rebounding either.
Ennis Kanter could have a really good series.
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, and that's exactly right. Like, you look at what Dallas likes to do on the second unit. If it's Lee as the second unit center, Kanter is going to absolutely destroy him, and Lee is not going to be able to take advantage too much. I mean, maybe your hope is you just space him out with Powell and hope to just, you know, outscore them in Kanter's minutes. But, you know, Powell isn't a dangerous enough shooter to really make you feel like, you know, Ennis Kanter, for all we make fun of him, is a beast on offense and a beast on the offensive glass. And I think he could do more damage to Dallas than Dwight Powell or someone of his ilk or D. Lee or Charlie Villanueva can do back. I mean, we may see some Salah Mejri, but that he's another guy who's really skinny, and I think Kanter would really have the advantage on the glass against him as well. And Mejri, not a guy who's, you know, a great pick and roll threat. He's kind of awkward, you know, doesn't really get up for alley-oops that well either. You know, he's not someone who's going to help kill Kanter in pick and roll. I mean, just the more you think about it, like, there seems to be almost no place that Dallas is going to have an advantage, and all of their purported strengths are very well canceled out by some of those from Oklahoma City as well. I'm going to go sweep. I'm sticking with that.
Yeah, I think it's also going to be a series where there aren't going to be many watchable games. Like, there might be a couple minute stretches that'll be really fun, but I just think that this will be a series that, unless it's close late, I don't think I'll be as engaged in it.
Yeah, this series and Spurs Grizz are clearly like the two worst on the board to me that I have very little interest in. I mean, is there anyone? I guess the other question for Oklahoma City is who is going to kind of be the wing du jour. Roberson doesn't really have much of a purpose in this series defending individually. He is useful, though, if he has to switch on to Dirk, if they try to do some more of those pick and rolls. You might even go with putting him on whoever the best point guard threat is. And he also has he's pretty long, so if you want to go under on some of those Dirk pick and rolls, if he's guarding someone like Barea or Felton, even if he goes under, he can kind of get a hand up a little bit, you know, bother him from behind a little bit more too. So I think he could still be useful despite the fact that he's not like one-on-one locking down anyone on the wing. I think that if I'm Oklahoma City, I'm probably going more with my defensive guys like Roberson, because I don't think Dallas is good enough to stop their main scorers anyway, you know, even if they are helping a lot. So I don't know. I mean, we'll have to see how Waiters plays, you know, and I think this will be Waiters' first playoff action in his career. And it may be the first playoff action for Kyle Singler as well. I believe it is. So some of those role guys, Morrow, not a guy who's played a ton in the playoffs either, and he hasn't been, you know, at the top of the rotation. We may see Randy Foy kind of get some more time. He's been more solid defensively than you would have thought, and he doesn't screw up as much.
It's elite post defense versus Darren Williams.
Yeah. The one thing that he does well, though, as soon as I said that on the show, he actually got scored on a couple of times the next game that I saw. But all right, that's enough on this series. You're saying five, I'm saying four.
Yeah, Hawks-Celtics. This is definitely a less clear series, and I've had a lot of trouble figuring this one out.
For injuries, Tim Hardaway injured his hamstring / groin, was seen limping around in the locker room after the Washington game. The Hawks have not updated his status, but if you injure your hamstring or your groin enough, because sometimes you'll injure it and it's like, all right, you can still walk around fine. It's just when you really try and explode, that's when you feel it. If you injure it badly enough that you're actually limping around, that to me makes me think that, you know, it could be a little bit longer than you're just kind of a tweak or something like that. And he actually has been, you know, kind of an important part of their team, and you can get away with playing him more too, because it's not like they have anybody on the wing who is either a great shooter or a great scorer where you're worried about him screwing up kind of mentally as much. And he's been shooting it well. You know, he's turned into a valuable player, you know, kind of since the All-Star break. I think for Atlanta, you know, it's not quite as simple as like what their best lineup is. You probably think it would be their starters, but we might see, you know, depending on whether Hardaway, Korver, or Bazemore has it rolling, you know, two out of those three end up playing alongside Teague and Horford and Millsap.
One of the things that I'm going to be really interested in this series is I've always thought, having covered him for a couple of years, that Kent Bazemore is very effective guarding ones. I think it's a kind of an interesting use of his skill set. And Boston's a team where that could actually be relevant, because Isaiah Thomas is such a key part of what makes everything move for them. And so I hope they try him on Thomas in some spots just to see how it works.
Yeah, that would be interesting. You know, we saw how Shumpert shut down Isaiah last year. The Hawks have had an elite defense and since January 1st, essentially. And you think about that, if they put Bazemore on Thomas, then you've got Teague guarding Avery Bradley, kind of coming off of screens. I think that, and Avery gets pretty good lift on his jumper. He might be able to kind of shoot right over Teague. Schroeder as well, when he's in, he did a real nice job guarding Bradley Beal at times last year when they would go with Damari on John Wall in that series. So I think that maybe you'll see Schroeder play against someone like Bradley as well. The Hawks do not play a very conservative style, and that to me is both good and bad against the Celtics team. I think it's good in the sense that they have like pretty mobile bigs. They're going to get out on shooters, you know, so especially when Boston goes with Olynyk at center, which is a lineup that killed the Heat the other night and really has caused some problems for some other teams having that shooting at center. The Warriors as well, their second unit in that game that Boston won in Golden State. But also, when you're kind of trapping on the pick and roll, now the whole kind of we're not going to guard guys, and Boston has a lot of guys, Turner, Marcus Smart, that you don't necessarily need to guard from three-point line. Amir Johnson is another one of those guys. Jared Sullinger, his jumper waxes and wanes. So if you kind of can't take advantage as much of, all right, we're going to just gum up the works here by helping out and just play conservatively and bring another guy into the lane to muck up because you don't have anybody who can shoot. You know, kind of they're a very different style than, say, like what Charlotte runs, and they were very effective against Boston on Monday helping off of the guys that can't shoot on Boston.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, but for me, the big dynamic of this series is, can Boston really do anything to handle Millsap and or Horford?
Yeah, this is going to be interesting. Boston does not like to switch. They also have elite perimeter defenders, Bradley and Smart, who are able to get through screens without a ton of help from the bigs. You know, what are they going to do? I mean, I think Bradley can just completely erase Kyle Korver if that's the direction they want to go in. But Boston also, I mean, I think Millsap is not a great one-on-one player, but there's also not someone you look at among the bigs as a great option to stop him. Jay Crowder matching up one-on-one doesn't really have a great guy to guard. Isaiah Thomas, you know, who are you going to hide him on if you're Boston?
You probably hide him on whoever the other, you know, the third guy, I would say. You probably put it so. Yeah. And
Bazemore,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah, Atlanta always has a third guy, too. It's just kind of the way their system works.
Yeah, I mean, if you're, and you would presumably you would put Avery Bradley on either Teague or Schroeder, whoever the point guard is. But then, you know, you're kind of giving up on, and then maybe Crowder would guard Korver, but then Crowder is a guy who's a pretty good help defender, so maybe not. Or maybe they would go with Crowder at the four and go with someone like Evan Turner, who has been, you know, has really improved his defense. He looked pretty good defensively through much of the year. I mean, he doesn't have the athleticism to stick with the elite guys, but fortunately for him, Atlanta doesn't have any of those guys.
Yeah, it's a weird series in that sense that a lot of the kind of the great strengths and weaknesses of these teams don't really mesh, and that's, I think, part of the reason why I've had trouble feeling out what it's going to look like, because Boston, you know, Boston has Jay Crowder, and Jay Crowder is a wonderful guy, and it's hard to really figure out what his purpose in this series is going
to
be.
Yeah, this is kind of a boring thing to say. I think it's just how well, there's a few things. I mean, I think Boston's ability to score is what's going to kind of determine this series. They have times where they can look pretty good on offense. They'll have times where they look pretty bad. A lot of that has to do with how Isaiah Thomas is playing. Also, another thing is, how much are they going to play Olynyk? How much can he get away with playing? Are they going to stick with Sullinger and Amir Johnson to start the entire time? You know, with the shooting that Atlanta has, you know, is Jared Sullinger going to be able to guard Al Horford in a pick and pop? Probably not. Is he then going to guard Paul Millsap? Maybe he could stick with him one-on-one. You know, he's quicker than he looks. But, you know, you probably don't love that matchup a lot either. So that's kind of my question for Boston. You know, which big combinations they do? Do they go Crowder at the four? Do they play Olynyk at the five? I mean, does this become just a really small series with a ton of shooting? Atlanta, on the other hand, I think could be in trouble when either one of Horford or Millsap is off the floor. I think that Boston's backup bigs are much better than theirs are. is Dennis Schroeder going to be able to run the offense well, avoid turnovers? He had some really bad stretches in the playoffs last year. I think he's kind of overrated by just his points per game. Anything else you see about this series that pops up to you?
Will Boston be able to generate turnovers? Because I think that's such a key to their offense, especially with depending on how Atlanta chooses to defend them. And from what I think about with Atlanta, they're pretty responsible with the ball. And there are also some weird issues with rebounding with both these teams. So I think there could be some games that swing on turnovers and rebounds.
Yeah, that's a good point, too. All right, predictions.
I've bounced around a lot, but I'm going to go Hawks in six.
Hawks six. Huh? So they're going to win on Boston's home floor. I do think that Boston is going to have a pretty good home court advantage in this series. Theirs will be better. I will go Hawks seven just because of the home court. I think that the Hawks have a little bit more experience now at this point. I think they have a little bit more top end talent. But, you know, I mean, it's going to be very interesting, you know, like whether the Hawks' ability to find that one-on-one offense in the playoffs and whether Boston kind of goes to switching or whether they're just going to stick with their very conventional style. I think that switching is what has been most effective against this Hawks offense. Otherwise, you know, if you're not switching, you kind of let them get the advantage with screens. If you do switch, they don't have one-on-one guys who are going to take advantage. That'll be another issue, too, is that, you know, whether they decide to go to that strategy. I guess I'd be very surprised if they started out that way. Yeah, I mean, and you know, is it going to be, I think that Olynyk and Johnson will probably be their best big combination in the series if you're going to play two traditional bigs together, because I don't think Sullinger has the mobility to really get out on shooters, although he's a pretty good positional defender, better than he looks, as I said. Yeah, just so many components here. I guess I will just go seven. I don't feel strongly either way. I mean, either of those two series could be total toss-ups to me. All right, well, let's get to Sunday, but first, let's get to Vistaprint. Vistaprint, a new sponsor of ours. We would greatly appreciate if you were to patronize them using the CapSpace code. And if you do so, you can get 500 business cards as a starter for $9.99. Vistaprint is basically your local print shop, except they have the economy of scale of the big boys. They have fantastic customer service, but both in terms of the design help that they have and their prices, they're able to do a much better job than some of the smaller stores. And Vistaprint has not only business cards, basically any kind of thing that you need printed for your business, whether it's coffee mugs, t-shirts, flyers, you know, just about anything that you need. I am a small business owner, as I talked about when I was trying to get you to do the survey, and I've used their services because I need business cards. I need things printed when I'm trying to go get sponsors and the like, and Vistaprint is a fantastic service for that. So if you don't like what they do for you, they will fix it for you totally for free. Their customer service has to be really good, and it is, and they also provide very easy customization. You can't beat the price, 500 business cards for $9.99 using that CapSpace code. That's how they know that you came from us and their advertising is working. So make sure you enter that and you also get a great deal for a great product, Vistaprint.com. I would rank this among the series that I am looking forward to, Heat Hornets, you know, probably in a tie with Boston and the Hawks. I really enjoyed these series with kind of playoff ingenues like the Hornets are, like the Celtics kind of are. They were in the playoffs and got swept last year, where it's young teams up and coming, especially going against a pretty loaded veteran team like the Heat, although they have some young guys as well. I really enjoy that dichotomy. And I think that this series, I hope, will live up to its billing. Where are we at on injuries for this series?
Well, so before that, I'll just note, you had this as a tie for one. This is number one with a bullet for me. I think this is going to be the most interesting series, and there are a lot of reasons. We'll talk about why. Injuries, still no update on Chris Bosh. Worrisome that we just haven't heard anything.
Yeah, I mean, we got to just assume he's out.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm assuming. Udonis Haslem has a left foot injury. He didn't play against Boston on Wednesday. Tyler Johnson isn't ready yet. That was a shoulder injury, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's been out for quite a long time. He hoped to come back at the start of this month, and just it hasn't quite responded to the rehab as well as had been hoped. So there's not really any indication that he's going to play. For the Hornets, Nick Batum sprained his left ankle in the Boston game. He did not play in their victory against Orlando on Wednesday, but said that there's no way he's missing game one. The fact that he gets an extra day until Sunday probably helps. That didn't look like that bad of an ankle sprain, so I am hopeful for them that he will be ready to go. And then Cody Zeller has a bruised sternum. That doesn't sound too serious. There hasn't been any indication yet that he's not going to play. I think that they're going to need him. But, you know, Al Jefferson is someone who's also has had a fair amount of success against this Heat team. So, you know, they may even want to start Jefferson to go up against Whiteside, at least offensively. Defensively, guarding him in the pick and roll might be a little bit of an issue.
It might be. And why I'm so interested in this is because these teams have such dramatically different strengths that in some ways negate the other teams. So Hassan Whiteside, very talented shot blocker, you know, has some nice rebounding nights, has a lot of nice rebounding nights, never passes. That will work against some of Charlotte's ensemble of bigs, but it really won't work against others. You know, if they go really small and put Frank Kaminsky at center, what do they do? How does Hassan Whiteside deal with that? And on a similar note, Charlotte's best defenders, you know, I would say Batum, you know, their best defender is probably Batum. Are they comfortable sliding him all the way down to probably to Wade and then putting somebody else, Jeremy Lamb or whoever else, on a three? Because Miami's threes are big. They're, you know, they're not small dudes. And so how these teams...
Yeah, they could go Marvin Williams there too.
Sure.
Maybe not at the three, but yeah.
Yeah, so it's just like how these teams handle, how they push their strengths, how they mitigate their weaknesses. And these are two coaches that I have a lot of respect for that are at different places in the process, and I'm really excited for it.
In general, I think that the strengths of Charlotte, you began to allude to this, match up pretty well with Miami. In some ways they do, and in some ways they don't. Charlotte does not have a ton of rim protection. Miami doesn't really have guys who get all the way to the cup that well. Maybe Dragic does, but like they kind of like to operate from mid-range a little bit more. That's good and bad, though, because the Hornets are very focused on not giving up threes. Miami doesn't really take threes anyway. You know, we saw in that game against Detroit that Miami was able to kind of just make some hay from mid-range. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see whether, you know, the fact that Charlotte's weakness might be defending the rim, at least, you know, in terms of shot blockers, works out okay, or whether, you know, the fact that Miami is pretty good at mid-range and that's kind of the shots that Charlotte's defense is designed to give up matters. Another thing, Charlotte, very disciplined, great scouting reports, excellent at clogging up the lane and helping off of people who don't need to be guarded at the three-point line. And Wade is one of those guys. Luol Deng has been shooting threes more. He's okay. Justice Winslow doesn't really need to be guarded at all. You know, even Goran Dragic is a guy who, you know, he'll hit an open three, but he's not a huge volume guy from there anymore the way he was maybe, you know, a couple of years ago in Phoenix. For whatever reason, doesn't really have like a great pick and pop guy to play with either. And then on offense, they really like to space the floor. They generally have bigs who can shoot reasonably well. And they take a ton of three-pointers. They like to set screens for guys coming off threes. Nikola Batum is fantastic at shooting on the move, coming off of screens. That's a part of his game that's really been unlocked in Charlotte in a way that perhaps it wasn't the last couple of years in Portland. And Hassan Whiteside is absolutely terrible at getting out of the lane and getting out on shooters, you know, helping in those sorts of situations. On the other hand, they have nobody with really much length or athleticism inside to deal with Whiteside either.
Yeah, they don't, and they don't really have a guy that I trust at the one or the two to really handle Dragic or Wade.
Courtney Lee doesn't fall in that category.
Oh yeah, sorry, I forgot a little bit about him. He can do it for stretches. I think Wade is somebody who's just so strong though, it could give him trouble.
Yeah, it is going to be interesting, right? Like if you've got Wade and you've got Joe Johnson, Courtney Lee is, you know, he's better kind of defending traditional two guards. Wade, you know, plays more like kind of a three, likes to bully ball a little bit these days. Joe Johnson, you know, also can kind of work in isolation. I think Batum has enough length to do okay on him, but Batum is not that strong of a guy. I'm very interested to see how that'll work out if Joe Johnson tries to score on him. And then, you know, maybe they switch up and put Marvin Williams on Joe Johnson, and then it's Batum on Luol Deng, you know, who he can handle just fine. Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things to this. The other thing I'm going to be watching very closely is what happens with Miami's crunch time offense. Is it going to be the Wade and maybe a little bit of Joe Johnson show all the time? Are they going to get the ball to Goran Dragic at all, or is he going to just be kind of hanging out? How does Charlotte do defending the pick and roll with Wade and Whiteside or Dragic and Whiteside, especially when Al Jefferson is in the game? If Al Jefferson starts, Whiteside is not that good defensively. He's not very disciplined. Can he guard Al Jefferson in the post? That's another one. And then also, can Justice Winslow stay on the floor? I think he can really give guys like Batum some trouble, Lamb, maybe even someone like Jeremy Lin trouble. But I think that it's still a question as to whether Winslow can stay on the floor offensively with the defensive discipline that the Hornets have. What do the stats say about this one?
I think that for the one of the other big questions with this, and we just talked about it with Boston, is Charlotte doesn't turn the ball over. And Miami is a very interesting transition team. They have some guys who are very capable in that. They're a little bit older and slower, so they can't take advantage of it as much as they could during the flying death machine years when LeBron was there. So will they be able to do enough there to generate some offense?
Yeah, that's a good point. Josh Richardson, is he going to keep shooting threes at this completely insane level that he suddenly reached the last couple of months? I don't know. Tough call. I think a lot of this series is going to come down to whose bench plays better. These have both been pretty solid benches this year. Per 538 has this as basically 51-49. The Hornets, a superior team throughout the course of the year, 2.7 point differential compared to the Heat's 1.6, but the Heat do have the home court. I'm going to do it. I'm going to pick the Hornets. Hornets 6.
I'm going Heat in 7. And I think in a lot of ways, this is going to be a great test of how relevant Miami is to this overall picture, because you could make an argument that Charlotte is the worst of the matchups for them. And so if they're versatile enough to survive the series, that makes it really interesting against the Raptors.
Yeah, and a lot of this is going to be matchup based, but we haven't seen a lot of these players in the playoffs. We haven't seen Whiteside in the playoffs. Charlotte has never won a playoff game since the franchise reboot in 2004. So I think they'll at least get one. I think that their home court advantage has been awesome. It's going to be awesome in this series. Maybe I just really like this Hornets team for whatever reason, and I may regret this. But yeah, I think I will stick with this pick. I, again, don't feel particularly strong either way. Both of those series, I think, are going to be great series, we can hope. I mean, I guess my only concern is just that, the Hornets kind of lose close games in the first two games, and just kind of, the Heat's, like, veteranness and poise wins it for them, to whatever extent you can even measure those.
One thing I have to mention before we move on, Miami is going to get so many calls in this series. I just feel like Wade, the refs are going to see a lot of stuff with him, especially depending on, if he plays some bully ball. I just think Miami's going to get a ton of calls.
All right, let's move on to Spurs Grizz, also known as the time to spend time with your significant others on Sunday, do some work around the house, and then maybe if it's close in the fourth quarter, by some miracle, you can tune in and watch it. Maybe this entire series preview could be injuries. Mike Conley is out. We saw him walking around on Wednesday, still in a walking boot. I think it's been reported there's no chance that he's really going to play, at least in the first round, and that is the only round that will be relevant for the Grizzlies. Marc Gasol is out with a broken foot, as we know. Tony Allen has actually missed the last three with hamstring issues, which he also struggled with at the end of the series against the Warriors last year. So kind of a perpetual thing for him. And he's actually been a pretty key player, but the Grizzlies have won, I think, one of their last 11 games. They are 4-13 since Conley went out. This is probably, at best, the 25th team in the NBA. The Spurs are in the top 25 teams all time during the regular season, maybe in the top 10. This will not be close.
I am excited for nothing in this series except for it being over.
Yeah, Boris Diaw has returned from a groin strain on Wednesday, so that would have been the only real Spurs injury to worry about. This Memphis team is going to have no chance of scoring against the Spurs. I mean, I think it's going to be, 95-75 every game. And I guess the other problem that this Memphis team has, too, is, they're not even really good at, slowing the pace down, and playing, the grinded-out style anymore. They've just been kind of jacking up shots, haven't been playing with a ton of discipline since Conley went out. I mean, I think before that, they deserve some credit. And they went on, a little bit of a run before that, but now I think reality has just set in. I mean, they were just not even really trying that hard in that game against the Warriors, you know, to not defend them well. I mean, nobody is going to win that game, you know, in that setting. But nonetheless, like, they did not look like much of a real basketball team. I mean, they had that one game at home against Golden State and one game against the Bulls. And that, you know, they've been relatively non-competitive the rest of the time.
Yeah. Do you want to just move straight to predictions?
I guess so. You know, I feel like I'm giving Memphis a little bit of short shrift here, but you know what? Like, it annoys me that this team is even in the playoffs, unfortunately. I mean, they kind of earned it, but, you know, I mean, maybe this is like, you know, this series is the big argument for, like, why the season needs to be shorter, perhaps.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, Memphis had that. They had a nice beginning of the year. They were doing what they've done so much and just kind of trudging along, and then they survived, and they deserve credit for that. They're going to get the playoff revenue for a couple of games, and, you know, that's fine. There's no shame in that. They've accomplished something as a collective. I'm impressed that, for the most part, they played pretty hard, even though they kept on losing. And so they'll get their nice little Spurs and four, and they'll be done.
Yep, Spurs and four. Cavs Pistons.
This is going to be more competitive than I think some people think. That doesn't necessarily translate into wins or necessarily even running longer. I just feel that it's going to, each game is just going to be uncomfortable for Cleveland.
Yeah, this seems like one of those games where it's just sort of like they stay in it, but like they're too youthful and they make mistakes. This is another one where I don't see Detroit getting a crap load of the 50-50 calls, you know, with the star power that's on this Cleveland team. I mean, I could see Detroit putting up a valiant effort and losing by like 8 or something in the first two games in Cleveland. And then maybe in one of maybe they like eke out game 3 and then just get destroyed in game 4 and then they're just done in game 5. Like, that's kind of the way I see this series going, that like one of those two games in over. I mean, you have to imagine that Detroit will be pretty rocking. This is their first game in the playoffs since 2009, when Allen Iverson was on the team, and they just, you know, got completely swept by the Cavs, and then they had been in the Eastern Conference Finals for like 7 straight years before that. But, you know, I don't know. I don't get an idea of like what the level of enthusiasm is around this Pistons team. They don't really have any superstars, but, you know, they do at least have the fact that they played Detroit, did pretty well against the Cavs in the regular season. So I don't know. Maybe I'm dismissing them a little bit too much, but I see it kind of being, you know, 5-game series, but, you know, 3 or 2 of the losses are like pretty competitive for Detroit.
This will be a kind of a big test for me of what Lou wants to do as a coach, because obviously Drummond is going to be a monster on the offensive glass kind of no matter what, but will he go to an approach of using, let's say, Channing Frye or Kevin Love at center against him to just get him out of the lane a little bit, or just create, if he refuses to, create an offensive advantage that way? Or will he go more traditional and say, you know, we're still going to be the favorites if we play Tristan, let's say, in those minutes? And the choice he makes there will give me a much better idea of what kind of a coach he's going to be long term.
Tristan Thompson is starting now. Mozgov, who was so key for them last year, I mean, they gave up 2 first-round picks to get that guy, and he looked like he was going to be worth it. And now, you know, I mean, I don't expect that he's even going to play a ton unless, like, Thompson gets into really bad foul trouble and, you know, they just decide that Frye can't deal with Drummond at all, you know, and Drummond is just beating him up on the offensive glass. I mean, I think they're going to go with LeBron at the 4 a lot more, especially because Detroit has 2 guys that can give Kevin Love trouble. And that might be one place where Detroit really tries to attack, is whichever of the 2 forwards, Harris or Morris, Love is guarding. You know, we'll see that's where they try to go for offense. I mean, they still have that Drummond-Jackson pick and roll as well. Jackson missed the last 2 games with an abdominal strain, but it doesn't appear to be serious. Indications are he'll be ready to go. So yeah, you know, like Detroit has some places to go. I think like KCP guarding Kyrie Irving will be a very interesting matchup in this series.
That's where I was going to go next. I think he could make his star in this series, even if they lose pretty dramatically, just because people will see what he can do defensively, like we saw at Oracle when he did a really nice job on Curry.
Yeah, and KCP might be a little bit better kind of chasing guys around screens than he is just like straight on the ball pick and roll, but he's still pretty darn good. I mean, people who don't know about him at all, you know, watch his defense in this series. He is so fast. And then not only that, he can decelerate so quickly as well defensively, get out in the passing lanes. He's a threat there. He's going to have to shoot really well on threes. I mean, that's going to be part of the issue too. You know, yeah, that'll be whether you know, Cleveland has to kind of end up matching up with those two scoring forwards that Detroit has, whether Kevin Love can get in the post. I think, like, either of those guys are guys he could actually be effective against in the post, especially on kind of his quick duck-ins. You know, the stagnant post-ups don't really work as well. And then also, LeBron had a terrible game against them the last time they played, and everyone actually played in the game. But you don't look at Tobias Harris or Marcus Morris as great options on him, although they do have a little bit more size to kind of just prevent the back down. I mean, this is LeBron shooting is going to be another thing to watch. He's been hitting it in the last week or so, but, you know, he's shooting like 35% or something since the All-Star break. We'll see whether, you know, you can go under on him on the pick and roll. So that'll be another thing to watch, too.
I think the big thing with this series will be what we learn about both teams that might be independent of the result. So this is a Pistons team that is really young, that should get better with time and adding pieces on the periphery, you know, guys like Jody Meeks, if they can be healthy, adding draft picks, things like that. And Cleveland, it's looking at them through the prism of the next 2 months. You know, are they willing to be experimental? Are they going to try Love and Fry together? Are they going to try LeBron at the four? And so it might not be as engaging in the sense of the immediacy, but these are two teams that are going to be relevant in different time frames, and it will be a nice window for that.
Yeah, and Detroit does have Drummond can maybe give him some problems. That's the other thing we got to talk about is, sorry, hack a Drummond.
Ugh. Yeah, that could be an issue. And also, again, how Stan Van Gundy handles it is in some ways more important than anything else.
Yeah, does he leave him in or not? I mean, hopefully this will be the last playoffs where this is an issue. 538 gives a 14% chance to Detroit of pulling the upset. Is that high or low to you?
Seems about right, actually. You know, there's a chance Cleveland is inconsistent enough that I could see them just blowing a game. Maybe a little bit low. Maybe it should be a little bit lower, like 10%, but 15 is not bad.
If they are both healthy, I think it is 10. I mean, some of that priced in is just, you know, someone gets injured on Cleveland or something. But really, I think only LeBron is the only one that could really, you know, would make the Cavs lose the series. Interestingly, though, 530 only has the Cavs with a 35% chance of making the finals. That seems comically low to me. I think they have a 75% chance of making the finals in my personal opinion.
Yeah, I might even have it a little higher than that.
We may be. I mean, the Cavs had a 6-point differential this year. You know, not like some awesome team. They won like, 56, 57 games, something like that. So maybe we are overrating them just because of LeBron. Maybe we are overrating them because they played so well in the playoffs without these guys. But, you know, I mean, this is going to be Kevin Love, other than three games. This is going to be the fourth playoff game of his career. Kyrie really did not get much of a chance to get going. He had a couple of good games in the playoffs last year, but was kind of injured most of the time. So, you know, how are those guys going to do? Is LeBron going to get pissed off at them or not? It's something to watch, too.
But one more thing. Other than Miami, a lot of these Eastern Conference teams are filled with playoff neophytes. That's not really, it's a difference, but it's not really a competitive disadvantage for Cleveland.
Yeah, I mean, I think Indiana might be kind of like the second most experienced playoff team at this point.
I think that's more structural.
The Hawks, too.
Yeah, I think the Hawks probably have more because, you know, Jan Mahinmi doesn't have a lot. You know, the guys that were the big part of the Pacers' playoff experience aren't really there anymore.
Yeah, but I do think that, to my recollection, research has shown that playoff experience, independent of just how good you actually are as a player. I mean, usually good players tend to have more playoff experience, but if you control for that, I don't think that playoff experience is actually significant in predicting who's going to win a playoff series. So I'm talking about it more and just like, hey, you know, I'm kind of looking forward to seeing a lot of new faces in the playoffs under that pressure and kind of how they deal with it. All right, let's move on to the one that I am most looking forward to, the LA Clippers and the Portland Trailblazers. For the Clips, everyone is not, you know, there are no acute injuries. For Blake Griffin, though, you have to wonder, will there be any kind of a minutes limit for him? You know, is he going to be explosive or not? You know, just the kind of form that he's in from an injury standpoint, you know, coming back off of that torn quad. He seemed to think it was feeling better and that he might not need surgery on it. I think he said in the last week or so. And then, you know, and especially he's going to need to hit his mid-range jumper at least a little bit. You know, if he can't do that, he's going to be given that shot, I think, quite a bit. And then Myers Leonard is done for the year for Portland, but everyone else is good for them. To me, this series starts with Blake Griffin versus Al-Farouq Aminu at the four.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And whether Aminu can really hold up with that. And the Blazers don't really even have bodies to throw at Blake. I mean, Noah Vonleh, I don't think either of us really trusts him there. So they're going to have to make do. But how well do they do that? And then how does Blake respond defensively? How are they going to handle that? I think that's a big part of it. And, of course, the point guard matchup is going to be really fun, but I don't think and if Chris Paul has one of those throwback defensive series, that could basically just snuff out any chance Portland had of winning. But I think you're right that Aminu Griffin will be very important.
Aminu is skinny. I think that Griffin, you know, could potentially put him in the goal, and especially when, if Doc is smart enough to stagger his guys, that Griffin could be more effective than he might be against, you know, some other players. They also might end up just, I mean, you could say, all right, we'll go with Plumlee. A lot of teams will like to put their center on Griffin. That's what Dallas did with Pachulia and put Dirk on DeAndre because he's not a threat just to create his own individual offense in the post. But then your problem is Plumlee is probably too slow. He's not really a good defensive player one-on-one. And then also you've got, is Aminu then? Are you going to switch the pick and roll with Paul if DeAndre sets it? That's something to worry about as well. Ed Davis is probably going to be too skinny to guard. He's got the length, but he's probably too skinny to guard Blake as well. And they've really only been playing now just those two bigs, Plumlee and Davis. I think that's a great strategy because their wings are way better than their bigs. I think actually Myers Leonard's injury and then the fact that it now not only did get injured, but then that forced him to take Plumlee out of the, Vonleh out of the starting lineup, and they just went with Aminu at the four. I think the fact that they've embraced that style, they're going to be really, really difficult to stop now. And so they kind of have a parade of wings that they can bring in. Gerald Henderson, Alan Crabb, obviously McCollum and Lillard. I mean, I think this is just going to be a rip-roaring offensive series, and I can't wait to watch it.
It's going to be fun in that sense. And one of the other challenges for Portland in this series is going to be that there aren't really a lot of guys that you can help off of on the Clippers, you know, whether the guys can create offense for themselves. You know, like, look at the starting five for the Clippers. Really, whoever they, you know, they play at the three, whatever that's going to be, that's really where you're going to do it from. And there are a lot of guys from Portland that will need help. Think about how their perimeter players are going to defend Chris Paul and JJ Redick. You know, they're going to struggle that way. And so how all of that fits together is going to be a challenge. I think that it's tough for Portland in that sense, but of course it was still better that they got the Clippers than, let's say, the Thunder or the Spurs or something like that. I think it's just that there's a big gulf, we've talked about it before, between the top four teams and everyone else. And so I think it'll be fun while it lasts, but I'm not sure it's going to last that long.
The Clippers are given a 69% chance of winning the series. Does that seem too low to you?
Substantially too low. It's hard for me to think of, other than the massive home court advantage they'll have in those games, just the theory of how the Blazers win this series is basically that the Clippers collapse. And that doesn't seem super likely. It's, of course, possible. They did it last year in the second round. But I think that the things that Portland does well, the Clippers do really well too, and do in a way that Portland can stop worse.
Yeah, DeAndre Jordan is someone who they are really going to have trouble matching up against. And I think Lillard has improved his defense, but him guarding Chris Paul, getting over screen after screen after screen, that's not his forte. They don't really have anyone else other than Aminu who's going to have to guard Blake, you know, to put onto Paul, who's a real lockdown guy on the wing. Maybe Gerald Henderson is someone that you could give a try to, and maybe what they'll end up doing is they'll put, like, you know, Gerald Henderson on Paul, and then you just switch pick and rolls with DeAndre or Blake, and Henderson's a pretty strong guy, so, you know, you hope that that'll work out okay. So that's an option for them. Yeah, I think another thing to really watch, though, is the starting lineup for the Clippers in the last few games has been Mbah Moute at the three and Blake Griffin at the four. Mbah Moute does not need to be guarded unless he's making a cut directly to the basket. And once Mbah Moute made sense when you're playing a four-out style and starting another wing at the forward position next to him. But now, and especially because Blake hasn't particularly found his jumper yet, play those two guys together, they make them a lot easier to defend. So that's really, I think, a pretty major concern for the Clippers, whether they switch that up. There also isn't really anyone for Mbah Moute to guard on Portland either. You know, he's too slow to deal with Lillard or McCollum. He's more of a kind of ISO wing threat kind of guy. You know, maybe you start him against Kevin Durant, but, you know, there's no one really. So I think getting him out of the starting lineup is probably something that they're going to need to do. What can they get from Paul Pierce? Has he kind of been, like, cooling his heels all year and still has something left or not? That'll be interesting to see. He's been a total non-factor all year. And then is it going to be Wes Johnson? Is that going to be their guy at the three? You know, that's a perpetual issue as well. I actually think that this series is going to be a little bit more competitive than people think, if only because with Blake getting reintegrated, I'm not sure I trust that yet. I think he will eventually come around. I'm going to say Clips in seven.
Okay, I can see the rationale behind that. I'm going Clippers in five because I think that Portland is going to get at least one game with McCollum. I could say six, but I think it's unlikely that I think that the Clippers, if that game happens, that then you would be right that it would go to seven. But I think that they'll take one of the two in Portland and then just seal it off because Lillard is great, McCollum is great, but they just don't have enough. And the guys on the Clippers that can pose problems for them, they don't have a way to mitigate it. They don't have the right personnel. You talked about how Luka and Pashar and Bamute doesn't have a guy to guard. Well, the Portland has no guys to guard the best players on the Clippers at any of those positions. So I think they're going to struggle, but it will be a ton of fun.
Yeah, it all depends kind of where Blake is. And I like to be conservative when guys are coming back from major injuries to just assume that they're going to be awesome right away. I mean, Blake has kind of saved things for the playoffs. He certainly did last year. And, you know, maybe he'll immediately be his old self. But I like to see that for a few games before I just make that assumption. And I also think that the Blazers home crowd is going to be really good. You know, I think the coaching matchup will be kind of a draw. But, like, if Portland hadn't gone to this style with Aminu at the four recently, I would feel a lot less, you know, if they're still starting Fonley, if they're still playing Myers Leonard 20 minutes a game, I wouldn't be nearly as high on them as I am now. I've really been impressed with what they've been able to do with Aminu at the four, that starting lineup. And then Harkless, too. We didn't even talk about him either. You know, he's been playing pretty well for them, too. They just have a ton of wings that they can throw. They got at the Clips. And I just think, you know, with Blake being reintegrated and going against such a non-traditional opponent where he's going to be guarding someone who can shoot threes at all times, that is exactly who they didn't need to be going against. You know, a more conventional opponent would have worked out better for Blake to kind of get his feet wet again.
That's a very good point.
All right, so let's go through our picks. Clippers-Portland, I have Clips 7. What do you
Clips
have?
Clips in 5.
Cavs-Pistons, you have?
Cavs in 5.
I don't think I ever gave mine specifically. I'll go Cavs 5 also. Spurs-Grizz, we both have a sweep. Heat-Hornets, I had Hornets 6. And what did you have?
Heat in 7.
Yeah, and I think the series is as close as could be. It's just when you pick the road team, I think it's more prudent to go 6 a lot of the time.
Agreed.
Hawks-Celtics.
I think I said Hawks in 6.
All right, and I said Hawks 7. It's actually, I hope that these predictions are right. These are going to be some good series. Dallas-OKC, I had OKC sweep, and you had...
In 5.
In 5, okay. And then Warriors-Rockets, we both had 5 for the Warriors. They're, usually whenever I'm conservative with my Warriors predictions, they always blow past it, so look for that one to be a sweep now that we've predicted that. And then Toronto and Indiana, I said Toronto 7, and so did you, which I was thinking that was going to be a pretty sexy pick to go 7, but apparently you also...
Well, I've been hyping that series for such a long time. I think that was... I'm not ready to predict the Pacers yet, though I could be sitting here on, let's say, I can't remember when game 2 is, on like Wednesday or Thursday, being like, I wish I had been bold enough to do it. But I'm not sold on the Pacers yet, but I think it'll be a really fun series.
Of Cleveland, OKC, the Spurs, and Golden State, who is the most likely to lose or even get taken into a long series?
Cleveland. They're facing a stronger opponent, and I think that they're not as consistent, or they don't, like, OKC is probably less consistent, but they're facing Dallas. So, you know, if Cleveland was facing Dallas, I would say Cleveland. But, you know, it's that. I think it's Cleveland pretty clearly.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, Houston has the most talent of all of those teams that are remaining, and they've shown the ability on occasion to get to a really high level this year, not even necessarily for full games, other than those last two when they're playing against teams playing out the string, but even just, you know, for halves or something. So maybe they just go nuclear in one game, but they're not going to be consistent enough. I would agree with you. I think that Cleveland is the most likely.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
One thing, I didn't do this on the Real Jam Radio for this week, for this round, but I always like to think about who's going to gain a lot from this. So you can think about it from a money standpoint or a fame standpoint, because there are so many guys that are going to be free agents, but somebody, it might even be somebody that we've been touting for a while, but who will kind of raise their profile with round one.
Oh, I wish you had told me this ahead of time. I could have come up with a really good answer.
I didn't think of it until just now.
Let me think on it. And there's a lot of kind of pending free agents Harrison Barnes is, I mean, not necessarily from just this run, but just this playoffs. You know, I think if he just, you know, plays the way he played in last year's playoffs, even, you know, he's going to get a max contract offer from somebody, I think. I mean, among sort of the newer playoff teams, Jeremy Lin can be a free agent. It is a pretty weak point guard market. Can he parlay a good performance into a starting point guard gig in like Brooklyn or something? You know, and get like a 3-year, $10 million a year contract or something like that as sort of like a third guard, you know, guy who starts and then you bring in someone else and he's the third guard the next couple of years. That's one that occurs to me.
My two, I'll give you two and they'll give you some time to think. They are a very different flavor. Neither one of them is going to be making or losing themselves any money because they're under contract for next year. First one is Miles Turner. We've been talking about how good he is. I think that he has the potential to have not a huge series, but to just have a nice impact in that. Probably in a losing effort. I mentioned KCP before. I'm not going to mention that again. And then the other guy, the man who I advocated for the Clippers to trade, is Chris Paul. I think this is going to be the series that builds his legacy in terms of, holy crap, this guy is still incredibly good. Lillard is a wonderful player. I'm not taking anything away from him, but I think people will walk away from that series thinking about how amazing Chris Paul still is.
Yeah, that's quite possible. Paul, another guy who kind of takes it to another level in the playoffs. I mean, it would be impossible for him to have a better series than he had against San Antonio last year. I mean, you know, that shot, that game winner that he had, because they lost in the next round, is kind of been lost to history already. I mean, you know, the guy tore his hamstring halfway through the game and still was unbelievable and hit, you know, the game-winning shot to dethrone the previous year's champion for a team of alleged chokers. You know, that was just an unbelievable shot. You know, a few others that I would just list: Hassan Whiteside. You know, if the Heat flame out in the first round and he kind of, you know, plays 20 minutes a game and Spo ends up not trusting him and, you know, they can't deal with Charlotte's shooting when he's on the floor, versus if they make it to the conference finals, you know, and he gets plenty of exposure, that would be a big one. You know who else? Deion Waiters.
Yep.
You know, if he actually plays okay and they make it to the conference finals, and especially if they bring back KD, you know, I mean, that's the biggest thing, obviously, the Thunder. I mean, if they flame out in the second round and like they're not even competitive, you'd have to imagine that KD is going to think very, very seriously about leaving. If they lose in seven to the Warriors in the conference finals, you know, it would probably be hard for him to say, all right, you know, this is an all-time great team we just lost to. Like, we want to try and get over the hump next year. I mean, so that's the big, I mean, Oklahoma City still, in the long term, when you just look at like what their team's going to look like next year, they still have the most at stake. I mean, let's not forget that. I mean, they're going to sweep this first round, I think. But, oh man, that Spurs-Oklahoma City series.
Yep, that's good. That's going to be, you know, probably my number two most anticipated series of this playoffs and last playoffs, if you were to combine the two.
All right, I think we're out. You got anything to plug? I guess your own playoff preview, correct?
Yeah, that I'll do that. And I'm working on a piece that's not yet finished, but will be by that point, about just for Warriors World, about the kind of the relevance and resonance of 73 wins. I think that it will be lost in the shuffle because it is not this Warriors team's primary goal. But I kind of wanted to write about just how ridiculous that is, so that, you know, 2 months from now, 2 years from now, people can really remember how insane that is.
Yeah, if they win the championship with the 73 wins, we'll do something special, I'm sure, on this show, whether it's kind of going over their 10 most ridiculous wins of the year. Like Dre was talking about that on Bill Simmons' podcast today, that they had all these games that they never should have won that they ended up winning, or maybe even just, you know, aggregating together all of our content throughout the year on the Warriors, and maybe we can like sell that as like a separate kind of one-off thing for anyone who is interested or something like that. But you know, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, but the point,
2 months of awesome basketball.
Yeah, the point that I wanted to make with that, though, is that even if they don't win the title this year, I think that 73-9 holds up as a remarkable accomplishment all the same.
Yeah, no one's going to see it that way.
Oh, of course not. That's kind of why I was making the point. Because it is, if to me it is. And yeah, I mean, the direct analog is that Patriots 16-0 team that lost to the New York Giants in the Super Bowl. But there is still an importance to that in the modern era of being better than everybody else in the regular season.
All right, follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. With the playoffs going on, I will probably be live tweeting at least 75% of these games, unless I'm at Oracle Arena preparing for a Warriors game. So I really love doing that, love interacting with everyone. If you tweet at me and I can't respond, sometimes it's because I'm actually watching the game, but I try to get back to people as much as I can. Love hearing what kind of people's theories are and what the zeitgeist is about a given game. And also, please do not forget that survey, podsurvey.com/catspace. Let's set some records. records on that with the response rate. We would really appreciate that. This is a critical time for the podcast, and getting a good response rate from that is going to get us some advertisers. We're not going to go crazy with it. We'll only have two during the show and maybe one pre-roll. You know, 3 minutes of commercials for an hour show, not too bad when you consider that TV is, you know, 33% commercials. So
and it'll be
please
free.
Help us out there. Yeah. Podsurvey.com/capspace. Talk to you all next time.